All right, good morning, everybody. It is 8 o'clock, September 15th, Tuesday, and we're here for a Chem 30A lab lecture. And thanks for joining me. I've got the diehards. I've got the few diehards who show up every time, which is great. You guys are seeing the value in showing up and being here with me at 8 o'clock in the morning. And everybody else is getting the recorded version. Hopefully, they're getting what they need. I really hope that this is working for everybody in there. They're getting good information. Let's start with a couple of reminders this morning. Let me go ahead and screen share my second monitor here. And just remind everybody, so what I've got is the Canvas shell opened up. And here on the Canvas shell, we have that module one. So this was chapter one, matter and measurement. And we had activity one that we did last week, math and the calculator, and activity two, dimensional analysis, that we also did last week. Those two assignments are due today, September 15th. So those, if you haven't turned them in already, those are due in. And to turn those in, what you're doing is, and I don't know if I can show it to you, but when you go to this in the student view, in the upper right-hand corner, there should be a submit button, and you can submit either screenshots or PDFs of your documents up in that upper right-hand corner for each one of those activities. So that's where you would turn those in. And I think you guys are probably already figuring that out. And since those are due this morning, I thought one of the first things that I would do is just open it up for questions really quick before we start our next activity. We're into chapter two, and our activity for today is atoms and elements. And so I'll pull that up in a minute. But first, I want to give you a chance to ask anything on math and the calculator or dimensional analysis, any sort of questions that we can answer on those documents since those are due today. So you can either unmute the microphone or you can throw it into the chat if you have any questions on those. And if not, if nothing's coming up, then I'm happy to jump into our assignment for today. Okay, well, while you're thinking about that, if something does come up, go ahead and break in and let me know. And other than that, I'm gonna move forward here with lab activity three, atoms and elements. And we'll take a look at what this activity looks like. So this is atoms and elements. And this is an activity that we generally do in the lab. It's not a wet lab per se, but we do spend some time looking at the different elements and what the elements actually look like. And there is a section here that, the introduction to the lab first. I'm sorry that I'm scrolling a little bit fast. The introduction to the lab talks about the subatomic particles, the protons, the electrons, the neutrons, the nucleus, what we call the atomic number and the mass number. They talk about isotopes. We're gonna go through all of these things. So we'll break it all down for you. It talks about the layout of the periodic table and certain groups that are in the periodic table that we like people to memorize and know where they are, because we refer back to those groups quite frequently. So we'll cover those. And then the physical properties of elements, the physical properties of metals and nonmetals. And they give you a spot here where we write down the element names, the element symbol, their physical properties, the type of element that it is. But these are all done from physical observations, where we have test tubes set up in the lab, and each test tube is clearly labeled and has a sample of that element in it. Most of them are metals, and so they look like metals. They're shiny, they're hard, they clink around in the glass when you jiggle the glass a little bit. The non-metals have some colors to them. So the non-metals, some of them are different colors. They tend to be powdered materials or amorphous sort of solids. Some of them are liquids, some of them are solids, some of them are gases. And this part we won't be able to do, and we'll describe what some of those metals look like, but we're going to leave this section of the table blank. And we're going to start our activity with exercise B, with filling in the periodic table. We will fill in some of these questions where we're looking at the element names, the atomic number, mass number, protons, neutrons, electrons, some isotope symbols, nucleate symbols. These are all the things that we're going to do. And so it's supposed to be an orientation to the periodic table for the most part. And that's where I want to start. So I'm going to backtrack. I'm going to close this out for right now. I'm going to screen share my iPad, and we'll start back from the basics and look at what we know about the periodic table and cover some items of how elements are constructed and what they're made out of and how we refer to them and the symbols that we use. So let's go ahead and start that. Let me close this out. Push these guys out of the way. We will stop the screen share. And I'm going to start screen sharing on my iPad. So you guys will be able to see that. Okay, and hopefully that comes up now, which I haven't seen it come up yet. Usually that works. Unless there's a window hiding from me. I'm gonna scan through all my windows really quick. There it is. Okay, so you guys are seeing it. You guys could help me out by throwing that in the chat too. You don't have to let me struggle here looking for windows. All right. Notability. There we go. Now we're in good shape. All right, so when we start off with the periodic table, and I have to confess that I have not watched any of Krista's lectures yet for this, so I'm not entirely sure. I watched a little bit of her lab video for what she was going to focus on in lab, but I did not watch the lecture videos. So I don't know kind of where you're caught up just yet. So maybe it's a good idea to ask, have you guys watched Krista's lectures for chapter 2 already on the periodic table? Not yet. Okay. There's one posted. There should be one posted. She should have actually all her lectures up posted. For this chapter. She's got all her lectures for all the chapters posted already. So I believe she has, it's only half the slides? Oh, interesting. Okay. Maybe she's still working on the other half. She's going to get that posted up here pretty quick. Well, let's start from scratch then, shall we? Okay. When we look at the elements on the periodic table, there's 118 elements. And one of the things that maybe I could do then that might be helpful is to actually bring a periodic table into the notes. So we're going to cover elements and the periodic table. So there's 118 elements on the periodic table. Out of those 118 elements, most of them are stable elements that make up all the things that are around us, all of the things that we can see, touch, and feel, and smell. Everything on our planet is made up of these 118 elements. Some of these elements are radioactive and unstable. Some of these elements are so unstable that they live for only milliseconds, and then they decompose into other more stable elements. And I have a periodic table that I usually like to bring in. Let me think about where I have it. Sometimes I can get to it through certain menus. Let me see if I have it in the Chem 3 or 30A. Oh, I should have grabbed this ahead of time. It hides in different places. That's the one that I want. All right, so I'll screen share this with my iPad. Oops, brought it in the wrong spot. We'll screen share one more time. You click too quick. I need to find notability. There we go. Add to this note. Import. Okay. Here's a periodic table. And this one, I need to finish it out. The elements that are down here that go to 118, it looks like this should be the bottom of the table, but really the way this table is constructed, the table is constructed such that these blocks that are right here, these guys slide in into the table over in this location right here. So the last row of the periodic table is actually this row. And you can see that the numbers, that they're all numbered 57, 58, 59, 60. Down here it's 89, 90, 91. The last two are 71 and 103. But those aren't the highest numbers. The highest numbers are 118. So this right here, this is the last row of the periodic table. And you can see that Rutherfordium here, 104, and Lawrencium, 103. So it goes 103, 104, 105, 106, and they go sequentially. These elements on the periodic table are arranged in families of similar chemical reactivity. And the families go vertically here through groups, what we call groups. And then we have rows that are called rows, periods is what we use for those. And the symbols, if you look at them, some of them have single symbols like carbon and nitrogen and oxygen. Some of them have two symbols, chlorine, bromine, krypton, copper, zinc. The majority of them have two symbols, and the names come from all over the place, and the symbols come from all over the place. So we will highlight out some of these. Some of these elements have been known for a very, very long time, and their name is reflected in the length of time that we have known about them, because the names come from old languages. Some of the names are from German, some of the names are from Greek, some of the names are from Latin, and so the names come from all over the place and generally reflect either the time frame in which the element was discovered, or sometimes elements were named after famous scientists. So the names come from all over the place. So we have 118 elements, and they are organized by atomic number. So this number that we see in the upper part of the periodic table, the 1, the 2, the 3, the 4, the 5, the 6, that's the atomic number. And you can see that they are all numbered sequentially throughout the table. So there's no gaps. It goes from 1 to 118. And interestingly enough, that there used to be gaps in the periodic table. There used to be places, particularly down here, like 113 and 117 and 118, these used to not be filled in just a few years ago until scientists discovered these elements and could actually verify that they existed. And then we propose names for them. And so right now, these names here actually are completely filled in names. I was looking to see if I had named them all, and I did. These had temporary names. When we discover an element for the first time and it hasn't been discovered before, we give it a temporary name. That temporary name goes along with its number. So it's a name that reflects the atomic number until such time as scientists propose a name for that element. And then that goes before a chemical body called IUPAC. It's the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. And they are the body that is responsible for all naming all compounds and elements. And they then go through a debate on whether or not that name is appropriate. And then they approve the name, and then the element gets its official name. Okay, so let's backtrack even farther. Let's backtrack to where do all of these elements come from? These elements are produced in stars. So let's start here. Where do the elements come from? The elements are let's back up even further. Our current understanding of the universe is that the universe started in a Big Bang. And when we go back to that Big Bang idea, for some reason, the universe started out as a very, very small ball of matter, essentially. And by matter, we use that term loosely as matter, that ball was incredibly dense. We call it a singularity. And it was infinitesimally small. You could not even see it with a microscope. There was no way to, it was that small. And in fractions of a second, it exploded. And when it exploded, it went through a rapid period of what is called inflation. And it bore or born the universe out in that explosion. And when we say inflation, we mean inflation over milliseconds. It inflated not to its current size, but to a size that is a size of a universe. And at that point, when the Big Bang happened, it was incredibly hot. So hot that matter could not condense yet. And it was essentially energy and subatomic particles that existed in the first few seconds of that explosion. And as it started to cool over millions of years, as it started to cool, those subatomic particles started to gel together, started to collapse and coalesce, and formed our first element, hydrogen. And so we went through the Big Bang, initially no elements. It was too hot to form elements. After cooling, for millions of years, the first element formed. That first element was hydrogen. Hydrogen, it's atomic number one. And we have a symbol that we write up here, and we look at the periodic table. And then there's a number that goes down below this 1.008. And so this would be the symbol in the way that we place that on the periodic table. Hydrogen has in its nucleus, the construction, the way that elements are constructed. Elements are constructed with a nucleus that is very, very small. And around that nucleus, they have what we call an electron cloud. And size-wise, the way that we describe it is that if we were to expand the atom to the size of a football stadium, that's one of the easiest ways that we kind of look at it. So we imagine that maybe we have taken this atom and we've expanded it up to a football stadium where we have the bleachers in here and we have the goalposts on either side of the field, and that atom is sort of superimposed over the size of the football field. What we say is that the nucleus sitting in the center there, that nucleus would be about the size of a blueberry. And the radius then, or the diameter of that element, would be the rest of the size of the football stadium. And so the electron cloud contains what we call the volume of the atom. And the nucleus contains two subatomic particles. These are the protons and neutrons. And these protons and neutrons are the mass of the atom. So all the mass is contained in the center of the atom, whereas the volume of the atom is occupied by electrons that are outside of that nucleus. So there's three essential subatomic particles that go into elements: electrons, protons, and neutrons. And hydrogen being the smallest, the hydrogen element has one proton and one electron. Protons are positively charged particles. Electrons are negatively charged particles. And so the element itself has an equal number of positive charges and negative charges and is neutral in charge. And it has zero neutrons. The hydrogen element, for its main isotope, has zero neutrons. We'll talk about isotopes in a little bit too, but let's hold off on that. We're still on the story of where all these elements come from. So in the beginning, if all we had was hydrogen in the beginning, then where did all the rest of these elements come from? And the answer is that they're born from stars. That for some unknown reason, as the universe was cooling, there were local pockets of high density of hydrogen that formed, and that hydrogen under gravity collapsed and formed stars. Now, what is a star? A star is nothing more than a giant ball of gas that is so dense that and so hot that the elements are moving extraordinarily fast. And as they move extraordinarily fast, you can imagine two hydrogens, and as two hydrogens are moving really quickly, they can slam into one another. And as they slam into one another, sometimes they fuse. We call that fusion. As they fuse, they add their nuclei together, they add their electrons together, and they make an element that is bigger, that is heavier, that has more protons and more electrons. And as that happens, we generate new elements, helium. So when we take and we combine two hydrogens together, and hydrogen plus hydrogen, so this is one electron and one proton, and we take one electron and one proton, and we fuse these together through fusion, we make helium, which has two electrons and two protons, and is a new distinct element in the combination of protons and electrons that that combine within that guy. And this continues within the star, fusing hydrogen until helium is made, until such time as there's enough energy within the star to actually start fusing the helium. And helium and hydrogen start to slam into each other and they make lithium. So let's look at where we're here. Helium here, hydrogen here. If I take and I combine hydrogen with a helium, I take one proton and two protons and I combine them together, I can make three protons. And when the star reaches certain size, when the star has burned through the majority of its hydrogen fuel and all the fuel that is left is helium, the star actually starts to fuse helium and the star gets hotter. And the star is getting close to the end of its life range. And that helium, as it fuses together and the star gets hotter, the stars typically expand because the heat causes expansion of the gases in the outer stages of the star. And it starts to make some of these heavier elements. But by the time it starts to get into the boron and carbon range, those stars that are so big and so heavy and so bright go through an explosion called a supernova. And in the supernova, in the detonation of the supernova, there is so much pressure and so much force and so much energy that all of the elements get slammed together that have been created already, and it makes elements all the way through the periodic table, generally out to iron. And then certain types of super explosions can make even the heavier elements on the periodic table. Those elements are spewed out through the universe through those gigantic explosions, and they seed new clouds, new gas clouds where there is large amounts of hydrogen. And those new elements then cause gravitational coalescence and the formation of new stars. But those new stars are seeded with these heavier elements. And when we look at a star, and we use a tool called spectroscopy, we can actually see the elements in the stars. What we see is light, certain colors of light, certain energy wavelengths of light that tell us that these elements are present in the stars. And so by looking at a star with light like this spectroscopically, we can tell the age of the star. We can tell whether it was a new star that was formed near the beginning of the universe, or we can tell whether it's a second or third generation star, like our star. Our sun is a second or third generation star that has heavier elements within the star. And that's how these rocky planets were actually able to form around the star, is that at some point in the early universe, there was a star that detonated, that went supernova, that released all of these heavy elements and seeded our universe and seeded our star. And rocky planets were able to form around that second or third generation star, which allowed life to actually take hold and take place. And so all of these elements that we see are born out of stars, and the stars are our element makers. And we're able to reproduce that to a small degree here on Earth with the types of instruments that physics creates. We create certain types of nuclear fusion experiments, cyclotrons and atom smashers, where we send atoms around a very, very large ring at very close to the speed of light. And then at some point we slam them together and we take hydrogen ions and we slam those hydrogen ions into gold targets and other very heavy element targets, and we slam them together. And when we do, we look for the elements that come out of that. We look for these very high energy elements that oftentimes are unstable and fragment and decompose back into smaller elements. And once we see those, then we investigate those, and that's where we come up with these very high energy elements that have very, very short lifespans, milliseconds worth of lifespans. And yet we can verify their existence. And it's not that we just verify them once. They have to be verified by multiple experiments, not even on the same instrument. We need to verify them on different instruments. And then once we verify them, then we give them names and we add them to the periodic table. And so the periodic table has been growing throughout time as we add elements to it. It was originally started, the organization for the periodic table was started by a Russian chemist named Mendeleev. And what Mendeleev did it was really cool. Mendeleev had the idea to be able to look at elements in the periodic table and how they combine with particularly oxygen. He was looking at oxides. And what Mendeleev found probably not spelling his name correctly. I need to look up the correct spelling of his name. I apologize for that, but let's go with this. What Mendeleev found was that certain elements like lithium liked to combine with oxygen in a 2-to-1 ratio. And sodium liked to combine with oxygen in a 2-to-1 ratio. Potassium combined in a 2-to-1 ratio. And what Mendeleev saw was that there must be something in common with lithium, sodium, and potassium because of the way that they're combining with oxygen in this 2-to-1 ratio. Other elements formed ratios that were 1-to-1, magnesium oxide and calcium oxide formed these 1-to-1 ratios. And so as an example, what Mendeleev was able to do was Mendeleev was able to look at the masses of these compounds and the mass of the element that we were looking at, lithium, sodium, potassium. And he saw, thank you, Kimberly, that's very helpful. We will correct it here. EEV. What Mendeleev saw was that in some of our understandings, there were gaps, holes in the organization. So for instance, let's look at cesium oxide, which goes in the 2-to-1 ratio. And if these are going in regular jumps in the periodic table, and we have sort of a regular jump in mass, and then all of a sudden we have too big a jump in mass, and there was a hole that was supposed to be here, then what Mendeleev did was started a whole trend of element hunters, of scientists who would go out and would look for these elements. And so what they would say is, all right, we know that there's an element that's missing here because there's too big a gap between potassium and cesium in the mass in that range. And so they would look at the type of rocks in which we find lithium oxide and sodium oxide and potassium oxide and cesium oxide. And we would go get samples of that ore, and we would start a deep dive into looking for an element that had a mass that fit in between potassium and cesium. And lo and behold, they would find it, and it would be given a new name, rubidium. And this would be rubidium oxide that they would then discover and find, and they would find that rubidium element. And so that's how they started to fill in these periodic tables. And that's why we say that these are organized. If we look at lithium and sodium and potassium, and rubidium and cesium, that these are in a family. A family that has similar chemical reactivity. We formally don't call them families, we call them groups. So a column is formally called a group. And these families or groups, the reason that I like the name family is because they're arranged in similar chemical reactivity. So every time you look down a column, anytime you recognize an element and you know something about its properties, like lithium, you can assume that the element that is down below it, sodium, is going to have very similar chemical reactivity to lithium, as is potassium, as is rubidium. They'll be unique in their own sense, but they will have some very common similarities. And we'll see later on when we get into electronic configurations, we'll see why that organization is the way that it is. And we will correlate the electronic configurations to the actual layout and structure of the periodic table, because that's how it's actually laid out, is by what's called electronic configuration. So the table has a bit of odd structure when we look at it. You know, we look and we see that the first row only has two elements in the first row. And then the second row has two elements, a big empty block, and then six elements, and then we go 2 and 6, and then we go through these continuous and we start filling in that middle block. The answer, or the, not the answer, the question is, why do we have those blocks? Why are they filled in that way? And that's a curious question that we'll have to wait to answer until we get into electronic configurations. Okay, so for now, what we know is that these are arranged in groups. So the groups go down. And in this direction, these are arranged in periods. Let's see how I can write it in here. I know what we'll do. Let's bring in another copy of a periodic table, and I'll see if I can shrink it. Okay, is it going to allow me to shrink this thing? Usually, sometimes I can select the whole thing. And it's not going to let me. Maybe if I do this. This will work. Okay. So what we have is we have groups. The groups go down, and we have periods. And the periods go across. So the groups, the periods are labeled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. This is likewise 6 and 7 because it is slid out from the table in order to make room for it because it's so long. So those are our periods. Let's take those periods. Don't do that. And let's style those in red. And the groups, notice that there are numbers that are already at the top of the table. And so my group number here is kind of fitting on top of that. The group numbers are listed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They go 1 through 18. Those are the group numbers. And there are also 1A, 2A, 3B, 4B, 5B. It comes back over here, picks up 3A, 4A, 5A, 6A, 7A. Those are really handy, the A values and the B values. There's two different types of groups that are there. And these groups have special names to them. So let's cover some of these. Let's highlight this in blue. And let's style and write in blue. So these guys, 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A, all the way through 8A. These guys are called the main group elements. 1A through 8A are called the main group or representative. These guys here, I need a different shade of blue. Maybe I'll go darker. These guys here that are darker blue, these are called the transition elements. And as we name them. And the guys that are down below, these guys all the way down here, these are called the inner transition. So the table is sort of blocked out in this way. We have main group, which is this little bar that's here. And this bar that is here, or block, is probably a better word to use. So those are my main group elements. We have our transition elements. And then we have our inner transition elements. And we interchangeably use the A values and the B values with the numbering system, which is 1 through 18. So sometimes you'll see a number used referring to a group that does not have an A value. I like the A values. I was taught the A values. The A values are a little bit sometimes easier to use for specific jobs. Makes understanding the electronic configurations a little bit easier to use the A values and the B values, but that's for a later time. Okay, where do some of these names come from? If you look at the names and where these names are coming from on the periodic table, hydrogen and the symbol H, lithium, the symbol Li. As we start to look at names of the elements, element names and symbols, they come from various places. Hydrogen, it's just the first letter. Carbon, it's the first letter. Oxygen, the first letter. But then we get to some like lithium, and they use the first two. And when they use two symbols, the second is always lowercase. So it's really critically important that the second element always be written in lowercase, because when we start to make compounds and we start to write the elements right next to each other and in a formula that represents a compound, if you ignore the upper and lowercase, some elements then are difficult to be able to understand how they go together. For instance, cobalt. Cobalt is CO. But if we were to take and we were to write CO with a capital O, this is carbon, and this one is oxygen. And this is a compound that we call carbon monoxide. And so we don't want to confuse cobalt with carbon monoxide. And so the uppercase and the lowercase is very important in the way that we string them together. So we need to respect the upper and lowercase. Okay, some elements, when we get into things like sodium, the symbol for sodium is Na. And you say, all right, well, there's no Na in sodium, so why did they choose Na? Well, Na comes from natrium. And natrium was the Latin for salt. And sodium is one of the main components of salt. Salt is actually sodium chloride, a compound of sodium and chlorine. And so that element name was taken from the Latin, from natrium. And that's what we use today. And that is true for many of the different elements. I mean, you can look at gold as another one, Au. So gold, G-O-L-D, is Au, and this comes from aurum, which means shining dawn. And it gives us sort of the color of what gold looks like and where that name comes from. And so some of the elements in the periodic table are named after famous scientists, not necessarily scientists who discovered them, but scientists who were very prominent and worked in areas and they wanted to recognize, and they named these elements after those scientists. So rather than writing all of those down, I'll go back to the periodic table and I'll show you where there's a few of the scientists. Here we have Rutherfordium, which is named after Rutherford. We have Copernicium. We have Borium, it's named after Bohr. We have, where else in here? There's a few others, Einsteinium, that's hiding from me. There it is, Einsteinium, and Fermium, who's named after Fermi. Here's the element that is named after Mendeleev for his work in recognition of the first scientist to start the organization, the periodic table. So some of them are named after famous individuals. Others are named after locations, Moscovium, Livermorium. These are locations where we have large cyclotrons that these elements were actually discovered. And so Livermore, we have the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories that that has discovered many elements. Moscovium, there are reactors in Moscow where elements have been discovered. What else do we have here? We have Tennessee is reflected in that. Anyway, so we have places, europium. We have names of famous individuals. We have names of elements that are very old elements, and we have names that come from different languages. And so this is why I say that chemistry really is a symbolic language, and you need to learn the symbolic language much the same way that you would learn Mandarin. We need to learn the names and the symbols, and before we can start to construct sentences and to speak a common language, we need to learn the basics and foundations of each one of those letters in that language. And for us, our letters of our language are literally our elements that we're going to be putting together to construct chemical reactions and our sort of chemical phrasing, if you will. So that's where we go from that. All right, any questions coming up? You guys are being kind of quiet. I just want to check through and see how everybody's doing. So let me bring up faces and see if I'm getting some thumbs up and everything's doing okay. You guys are following along. All right. What I need to do now is talk a little bit more about the layout of the periodic table and some special groups in the periodic table. So let's use this periodic table here to denote some special families. Some special families. We have the alkali metals. Alkali metals are group 1A. Group 2A, these are the alkaline earth metals. These guys, let's color them in. We'll start a coloring scheme. So here's our alkali metals. And we have our alkaline earth metals. This is group 2A. We have over on the right-hand side of the periodic table, these are called the halogens. This is group 7A. So our halogens here. And then at the very end of the periodic table on this right-hand side, the last column, we call our noble gases. Let's give them blue. So those are some special families that we want you to memorize, because we refer back to these families. We'll talk about noble gases that are within certain periods. So this is period 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And so we can refer to the noble gas in period 4 as a way of sort of like element bingo. So if we go to period 4 and we go all the way over to the noble gas, we find that noble gas is krypton, Kr. If I want to talk about the halogen, which is in period 5, I find period 5 and I go over to where the halogens are. Iodine would be the halogen in period 5. If I want the alkali metal that is in period 2, that would be lithium. So I go to period 2 and I find the alkali metal. And the alkaline earth metal, which is in period 7. So I go to period 7 and radium, and I can find those elements. So we do a little bit of element bingo in that way. Out of the periodic table, we already did the main group, the transition metals, and the intertransition metals. Let me block out the periodic table in another way yet. So let's take, and we'll drop in the periodic table again. And And we'll do some more notations. Okay. On the periodic table, and it's not highlighted very well on this periodic table, there is a line that resides here. And it is a darker line. I'm going to exaggerate it. This line is a division line between two main groups of elements on the periodic table. It is the division line between what we call the metals and everything east of that line, excuse me, everything west of that line. These are all metals. And everything to this side are non-metals. And everything that is touching that line at two points, we generally think of things like silicon, germanium, arsenic, antimony, tellurium. These things, these elements that are touching two bars of the line, we call metalloids. So what are the properties of metals and what are the properties of non-metals and metalloids? Well, metals, generally easy to describe. These are things that are generally shiny. They're malleable, meaning that they can be hammered and bent without breaking. Means that they can be hammered into a shape. They conduct electricity. They conduct heat. And most are solids at room temperature. And standard pressure. So those are our metals. And you can think of a piece of steel or iron or even aluminum foil, all of those things that tend to be shiny and sort of silver in color and hard. Those are our metals. Okay, our non-metals are just the opposite of this. Oh, I should also say, before I get to that, oh no, I said most are solids. There's exceptions. Mercury. Mercury is a liquid at room temperature. Okay, non-metals, properties. Non-metals are dull. They tend to not have that shiny luster. So if you think about a piece of graphite, carbon coming out of your pencil, that's one of the easiest pure non-metals that I can think to point you to that is not a compound. That shows how things can be sort of dull. And that's a really good thing to refer back to is that pencil graphite, that lead. They tend to be dull. They tend to be brittle. We're always upset when we break the lead on the pencil and that it doesn't just bend and we can bend it back and keep writing. It snaps off and we lose it. So they tend to be brittle. They do not conduct well. They do not conduct electricity. They do not conduct heat. This is why all of your frying pans are made out of metal and not out of some other non-metal. They are solids, liquids, and gases. You can think about oxygen and nitrogen and the gases helium and hydrogen. All of those elements are non-metals that are gases. We have many that are liquids. Bromine is a liquid, and we have some that are solids. Iodine, for instance, and sulfur and phosphorus and silicon. All of these elements are solids. And so the non-metals come in solids, liquids, and gases. And we have all different styles there. And metalloids fall in between. Metalloids have properties of metals and properties of nonmetals. They tend to be shiny, but they tend to be brittle. So they're shiny like a metal, but they're brittle like a nonmetal. They semiconduct heat and electricity. Think silicon. Silicon is a semiconductor. So as a semiconductor, we're in Silicon Valley, and semiconductors are things that we use in computer chips that have some conducting ability, but do not conduct the same as a metal like gold or aluminum or copper. And so they semiconduct, and that's where that name semiconductor comes from. They semiconduct heat. And they also tend to be solids. Like a metal. So those are our metalloids. Okay. We've described most of the things around the elements. What we need to do now is we need to break down and talk about the structure of the element and what is inside the element. And I did that a little bit. I talked about protons, electrons, and neutrons, but we need to do that in a little bit more detail. We need to understand where things are located on the periodic table and where we go to get information. So any questions coming up so far as we're going through? See, I either take this and just say, I'm doing a great job, and you guys are getting everything you need, which is fine. I will take that praise. But it's also nice for you guys to stop and ask questions if you have them. Okay, I'm going to keep going. Hydrogen is the only nonmetal on the metal side of the periodic table. Kimberly, hydrogen is the problem child of the periodic table. Yes, that is correct. When we take a look at the way that the periodic table was organized, that's a great question. I love that question. Hydrogen on some periodic tables is pulled out and set here in the center, and it's put above everything else. But remember what I said about families and the way that hydrogen is in a family with other elements that are chemically similar to it. So think about the formula for water, and think about the formula for some of the other elements that I gave you, or the other, not elements, but compounds that I gave you. That's a great question. Some of the compounds that we talked about were sodium with oxygen. And we said sodium forms a 2-to-1 ratio. Lithium with oxygen forms a 2-to-1 ratio. And if you look at the head of that family, hydrogen being at the top of that family, hydrogen also forms a 2-to-1 ratio with oxygen. And that's water. And because it forms a 2-to-1 ratio, that means that it's very chemically similar to sodium and to lithium and to those other elements which are in group 1A. And so it really is the head of group 1A, but it is so light that under normal conditions, it's a gas. And so, yes, it's on the metal side of the periodic table, but it does so because it is chemically similar. And interestingly enough, if you put hydrogen under enough pressure, we can condense it down into a liquid. And you put it under even more pressure, and you pressurize it enough, we can condense it down into a solid. And when we do, it has the properties of a metal as that solid. It is shiny, and it can conduct electricity, and it does all of those things that metals do when put under enough pressure to actually do that. And that was a recent discovery within the last 20 or 30 years that we have technologically been able to condense it enough to be able to get it into a solid, to be able to actually observe that and say that. And that's where it really belongs on the periodic table. So yes, they're organized by electronic configuration, and electronically, it is identical to those other metals, sodium and lithium and the other things below it in the periodic table. And that's why it actually does live there, even though it doesn't have the physical properties in its normal standard state to represent those other metals. So great question on that. Thank you. Okay. Let's take a look at the structure of some of these elements and where things are found on the periodic table. So I had drawn out hydrogen, and I want to contrast the periodic table and what is a nuclide symbol. On the periodic table, we have an element, we have its atomic number, we have its name, and then down below it, there's a number that we haven't described yet. The number, which is up here above the element, this is the atomic number. This is the number of protons that the element has. This number down here, this is the average atomic mass. That number is actually really hard to explain. And we don't generally deal with that number until a couple of lectures down the road. And it takes a couple of lectures to actually explain where that number comes from and how to use that number. For right now, let's say that this average atomic mass is has two values for it. It is the atomic mass units, the AMUs. For an average hydrogen atom. And we'll leave it at that for right now. So AMU stands for the atomic mass unit. And one AMU, or one proton, is approximately 1 AMU. So a single proton weighs an AMU. One neutron weighs approximately 1 AMU. They're about the same size in mass, a proton and a neutron. An electron, one electron, weighs approximately 1/2000th of an AMU. So electrons weigh next to nothing compared to a proton and a neutron. And that's why it was important that when we looked at sort of that picture of an element and we said that this is the electron cloud that is on the outside, and inside we have the nucleus. And in the nucleus, we have the protons and the neutrons. That's where all the mass is. So here in the nucleus, it contains the mass, because protons and neutrons are so much more massive than electrons. But there's very little volume in the nucleus. The nucleus is just a fraction of the atom size itself. The electron cloud is much, much bigger. And so this is the volume, but not the mass. Because it would take 2,000 electrons in order to equal the mass of a single proton. And so when we're considering the mass of an element, we don't really even take the electrons into consideration because they're so light, because they just don't contribute much. Okay, but we were up here at nuclide symbol. So in nuclide symbol, we have a symbol for hydrogen. And in this symbol, what we do is we take and we put some numbers in the upper right-hand corners, the lower left-hand corners. The number in the upper left-hand corner, this is called the mass number. In the lower left-hand corner, we call this the atomic number. In the upper right-hand corner, we use and reserve for charge, if there happens to be a charge on the element. And in the lower right-hand corner, we reserve that subscripted position to put a number that tells me how many of the atoms I have, but I'm going to leave that off for right now. So this is a nucleid symbol. The other way that we write a nucleid symbol is we write out the name hydrogen, and then we give it a dash, and we put the mass number. So example, H1, 1, H2, 1, H3, 1. These are what are called isotopes. They are elements, all the same element, but they have different numbers of neutrons in them that cause them to weigh slightly different amounts. And so these guys are what are called isotopes. And we use the nucleid symbol in order to describe different isotopes. So let me take and write out these isotopes and show you kind of what these isotopes mean. And let's first define what an isotope is. Isotope is a relationship I think of it like a brother or a sister. It's a relationship between two elements. That have the same number of protons, but different numbers of neutrons. See, it's the proton that determines what the element is. The number of protons determines the element. Neutrons just add mass, but don't change what element it actually is. It just changes the mass of the element, and thereby we get the different isotopes. So when we look at these isotopes of hydrogen, and we look at the number, so here we'll put the isotope, we will put the number of protons, the number of neutrons, and the number of electrons that are in each one of these. So the isotope here would be H11. This is a hydrogen that has one proton, zero neutrons, and one electron. The number of protons and electrons are going to be the same for all of these elements that we're going to look at, because we're not going to look at any charged elements. For right now, elements in their elemental state off the periodic table are all going to be neutral, meaning that they have no net positive and no net negative. That means that they have the same number of positive charges and negative charges. And therefore, we're going to see that there is no charge in the right-hand corner here. When it's not written, when there is no positive or negative with a number indicating the number of positives or the number of negatives, then we assume it to be zero, and we assume that the number of protons and the number of electrons are equal, okay? This isotope, isotope 2, 1, remember that the bottom number, this is the atomic number, and that is the number of protons. So I'm looking at that number, and as I see that number one, that's my number of protons. So we can correlate that, and we can say, all right, this number is this number here. It's my number of protons that are coming out of this. And the isotope H3, likewise, has one proton. And that number of protons, that atomic number, is what tells me what element it is. So all of these are elements of hydrogen. they just have different numbers of neutrons that are in their nucleus. So when I look at it, the number that is up here, this is called the mass number because it tells you about how much mass the overall atom weighs. That mass number equals the sum of the protons plus the neutrons. So in order to figure out how many neutrons an element has, what I need to do is I need to take its atomic number and I need to subtract the atomic number from the mass number. So this is going to be 2 subtract 1 in order to figure out how many neutrons I have. So let's take this mass number, let's make it here and show that what I'm doing is I'm taking 2 subtract 1 equals 1. That's going to be my number of neutrons. So I have taken the mass number and I have subtracted from it the atomic number in order to get 1. Down here, I'm going to take 3 subtract 1, which is going to equal 2. And that's going to tell me that that element has 2 neutrons in it. And we can correlate this too with sort of a graphical representation that what I have here is an atom that has 1 proton, 0 neutrons, and 1 electron. The element that is here has 1 proton, 1 neutron, and 1 electron. Give it a negative symbol. We'll give it a positive symbol for the protons. And the element that is here has 1 proton. That's what makes it a hydrogen. It has 2 neutrons, and it has 1 electron. Okay, so why do we get these different numbers of neutrons? Where are these different numbers of neutrons coming from? Well, if you look at a table representation of the number of protons and the number of neutrons, what we find is that there is a ratio, a stable ratio of the number of neutrons and the number of protons. And it tends towards having more neutrons than the number of protons. And this is what we call a stable ratio. And that means that sometimes there are stable ratios for a particular element where we may be, let's say, out here at some atomic number, and yet there may be stable ratios where I can get various numbers of neutrons that are all still stable and combined to form that element. And all of those elements collectively are called isotopes. So there is no one particular isotope. It's like saying you and your sister, which one of you is the sister? You can't point to either one and say which one is the sister. It's a relationship that you two are in that you're born of the same family. These isotopes are relationships where they are born of the same family, slightly different in that they have different mass numbers, in that they have a different number of neutron, but chemically they react similarly in that they all have the same number of protons and the same number of electrons. So that's where these all come from. Oh, and there's a little island of stability that's out here in this table. And so what happens if we fall outside of the stable range? That's where we get elements which are radioactive and are unstable. So if we tend to be over here, what happens is the element will kick out neutrons as radioactivity. And we'll lose neutrons in order to fall into the stable ratio. And if we're out here, what happens is it will lose protons in order to fall back into a stable ratio. And these are radioactive elements as well. Unstable elements that fall back into a stable range. And so in the process of all of these stars slamming together the elements and making heavier elements, sometimes elements are born with more neutrons than are generally stable. And over time, they will lose those neutrons in order to fall back to an element that has a stable configuration. And likewise, sometimes elements have too many protons in them. And so they will lose their protons over time, degrading to an element that is a lighter element and actually becomes a new element in the course of undergoing that radioactive decay. So nothing is ever lost. Nothing is ever gained. Nothing disappears. We have a finite amount of matter that was ever created within the universe. And that matter can rearrange, but it is never entirely lost. It always, when a fragment comes off, such as a neutron, that neutron goes off and does other chemistry and other things, other places, but it never just disappears. It goes into the vacuum, or I guess it goes into the vacuum of space, but it never just disappears. It's always present in some form. So we have the conservation of matter, which is a very important property within chemistry, or very important concept within chemistry. Okay, so going through these isotopes then, that means that I can go through and give you an isotope and you can fill in a table for me and we can do a couple of examples of how we might complete a table. For instance, one of the questions that you need to fulfill within the lab is to look at an element. So let's do a couple of examples. You need to find the atomic number. You need to find the mass number, the protons, the neutrons, the electrons, and we need to fill in each one of these. Sometimes they give us pieces of information, and they have to give you at least two pieces of information to be able to complete the table. So one example here is fluorine. And they give us that the mass number is 19. So those are the given components. Excuse me. Let's fill in the rest of the table and see where we get that information. Let's go back up to our periodic table for a minute. And let's find fluorine on our periodic table. That's too far. We have to go too far. Let's bring in a new one because we're going to do a bunch of examples here. So we'll just bring in the periodic table again so that we don't have to give you guys whiplash scanning through pages. And then these are also all in the notes that get posted online. So you'll have these to go back to for support. Okay, first off, we need to find fluorine. And the periodic table, fortunately, includes the name of the element that is in there. So we have the name of the element. We have the symbol of the element. We have its atomic number. Its atomic number is 9. Remember that the atomic number is the number of protons that it has. So now that we have that 9, we can go back to our example here that we're filling in, and we can say, it's atomic number 9. Okay, well, its number of protons, that is the number of protons. So the atomic number is the number of protons. The number of neutrons can only be found if you have the mass number. So the mass number is the protons plus the neutrons. So in order to figure out how many neutrons there are, what we're going to do is we're going to take the mass number and we're going to subtract from it the number of protons. And that is going to give us 10 neutrons. And all of these elements, all of them that we're dealing with today are all going to be neutral elements, meaning that there is no excess of positive charges or negative charges. They have the exact same number of positive charges and negative charges, positives being the protons, negatives being the electrons. So the number of protons is also going to translate and be the number of electrons. And we have completed the table. So just mathematically here, what I said was mass number equals protons plus neutrons. And so if we rearrange that formula and we want to figure out how many neutrons there are, then what we would say is that neutrons is going to equal mass number minus protons. And so that's the little derivation of what we did there in order to be able to figure out the number of neutrons, mass number minus protons. Okay, in some cases, you'll be asked to use nucleid symbols. And so an example here is we may be giving you an isotope symbol. They call them isotope symbols in the lab rather than nucleid symbols, but they're nucleid symbols. And likewise, they ask you for protons, neutrons, and electrons. And so here, they generally start these off by either giving you a symbol. Let's do going too much here. Let's do 20 and 9. So we've been given a symbol, and we can fill in the rest of this table based on what was given to us in the symbol. So this number here, this is the atomic number. That's the number of protons. So that is going there. The number of neutrons, this is the mass number that's here. And so in order to figure out the number of neutrons, it is going to be the mass number 20, subtract the number of protons, 9, which is going to equal, in this case, 11. So we have 11 neutrons. And the number of electrons, this is a neutral element. So the number of protons and the number of electrons are going to be equal. So our answers would be 9, 11, and 9 moving forward. We could work backwards from that, and we can give you some of these numbers. For instance, we can give you 20, 24, and 20. And from this, we can construct a nucleid symbol. We'll call it X for right now. We'll figure out what X is in a minute. But it's going to have, switch to blue. It's going to have 20 protons, and it's going to have 20 plus 24, or 44 for its mass number. The number of electrons doesn't reside in the nucleid symbol. And now in order to figure out what X is, I need to go to the periodic table and find element 20 on the periodic table. So I come down here and I scan through this. I'm at 18, 19, 20, there it is, calcium. So X here really is calcium. And this is calcium 44, 20. And that would be the answer that I would report for that isotope symbol. Okay. What else do I need to show you? I think I've given you everything. And I also think that we're coming up on time. I can't remember exactly when we end class, but I know that we're close to it. But I think I've also given you all the skills you need to be able to tackle this entire sheet. I'm trying to look back and see if there's any skills that I did not give you or fill in for you. And I think we're good. Okay, so let me remind you by bringing in this worksheet. So we'll bring the whole worksheet into Notability. So now the worksheet is part of the notes as well, so you can see it. This is informational in the beginning that tells you how to go through and do the lab. And then what we said is that this part of the lab, we are going to cross off because these are observational. And we don't have the samples to be able to observe and do those. So we're going to ignore that piece. Here, this is complete the following periodic table. And so what they're wanting you to do is they're wanting you to add the element symbols into the blank spaces in the periodic table. So you can use the periodic table from your textbook, or you can use any of the periodic tables that I have included in the notes here to be able to complete that section. So this exercise B, we are going to do. So this will be what we're going to ask you to do, these questions and problems. We were just showing examples of how to go through and how to complete tables here with atomic number, mass number, protons, and they're giving you different pieces of information. You should be able to fill in the table and look up the names of the elements that are missing in the table and find those. So we are going to do that piece. We're going to do the isotope symbols and complete that piece. And then here, this is just a names and symbols, looking up the symbols on the periodic table to help you learn some of those symbols to be able to complete them and use them. On the following list of elements, circle the symbols of the transition metals and underline the symbols of the halogens. Those are special groups, and we've shown you those groups in the notes up above, so we're going to do everything in this section. Give the name and each of the following elements: noble gas in period 2, halogen in period 2, alkaline metal in period 3. I showed you examples of how to go through and do those. From their positions on the periodic table, indicate by circling metal or non-metal. So that's what they mean by these. This is metal or non-metal. And so you're looking at the element's position in the periodic table and whether it's a metal or a non-metal based on its position in the periodic table. They have stayed away from things that are metalloids, so you won't hit any metalloids that are in there. And then there's some further questions. Consider the element of chlorine. Explain how you would determine the number of neutrons in a chlorine atom that has a mass number of 37. So here what they're doing is they're saying you have a chlorine, it has a mass number of 37, and how many neutrons? You'll first need to look up its atomic number, and then you can use the combination of the atomic number and the mass number to figure out how many neutrons that isotope has. All right, that's all I have for today. So I was just going through and just giving you a couple of quick examples. We're all set. You guys are welcome to go. And I'll stay on the line if there's any questions.